Nahum, Habakkuk, and Zephaniah. So we're going to be doing this, but I want to kind of start off a little bit because I was thinking this week, I said, do we really understand the whole prophets and how they fit together? And we hear a lot of the doom and gloom and judgment that's coming. And what I don't want to do, and what I see often out there, is that there is a misinterpretation of that. And I want to clarify what's going on, because the misinterpretation will cause us to misinterpret the Gospels. And so I'm going to take a few minutes and talk about that, but before I do that real quick, I have Anna designed for me. So the last Sunday that I'm here, we're going to do a question and answer period. So I will answer any questions you have. People say, does it have to be Old Testament? No, it doesn't have to be Old Testament. It could be anything. I always like challenges, and I have a lot of vacation, so this will be fun for me to delve into. So this is Anna's wonderful box. I love the eyes here. So she has a smiley face and crying on this side. I don't know what that is supposed to entail.
Good and bad questions.
Good and bad.
I thought that was the theater.
She has a QA, and it says box on the top. So if you didn't know it was a box, it's a box on the top. It's a wonderful job.
I didn't have anything to work with.
So she played right there. We have little notes right here on. So all you have to do is write your questions, put it around. I will pass it around starting over here with the figures, and then you just pass it around if you want to put it in there. We also take cash, check, and credit card. So anyway, that is what it is. But yeah, that is, so to try to help us do that. So we're going to finish up a little early. Next week, Joel is going to be here. Are you here for 2 weeks or just next week?
Week, then it's you, then it's me again.
All right, so next week is him. He's giving me a day off, which I'm glad. And then I will come back, and then he'll do another one, and then we'll finish it. We'll be finishing out here, so the minor prophets. So I want to talk about something that I think causes a lot of misinterpretation of the prophets, but the Old Testament itself. And so I have listed here, and I have it on the front of yours, this kind of diagram here. This isn't original with me. I didn't come up with it, but it's a really good illustration, so I stole it. That's what I do. And I want to talk about what we look at when we're looking at how the Bible fits together. And in basic parlance, we look at the Bible as being basically two different covenants. Now, covenants, hold on a second. Forget about that. Covenants are God's way of bringing us into his kingdom as his people, all right? And so these are two different covenants, and we have two basic ones. One's called the covenant of works, and the covenant of works is also called a lot of other things, covenant of creation, covenant of the Adamic covenant. There's several ones that you have. We just use the word covenant of works, and that here is where we kind of see creation. And we see Adam within that covenant of works. And this is before the fall of Genesis chapter 3. And so in the Garden of Eden, we had something specific going on, is that man was not sinning. And so he was placed in the garden to worship the Father. And we said this back in Genesis. The goal, though, was never the Garden of Eden. The goal was eventually to be brought up into the celestial kingdom. And so how did Adam achieve that? Through obedience of God's commands. And he was under that probationary period where Adam was not a sinner, but if he obeyed, he would get the tree of life. So that meant his relationship with God was based solely upon his obedience to God's commands. Something happened. sin. And now this, you cannot, what happened here, you cannot get past here and apply it the same way you apply everything that comes after Genesis 3. Sin came. And as a result, we now are under the covenant of grace. The most beautiful woman in the world had just walked in, so I'm going to pause for just a half a second.
Hello, Bob. Good morning.
So everything now is about covenant of grace. That would include everything in the old covenant. That would include Israel, Abraham. That would include Moses and Sinai. Everything else was under God's grace by us. And the old covenant and new covenant are covenants of grace. We do not become saved in the Old Testament by keeping the law. We do not become, in fact, Hebrews makes that clear. You were never saved by the blood of bulls and goats. You were saved by, how were they saved in the Old Testament? You can't answer. You know all my answers. How were they saved in the Old Testament?
By faith.
By faith in
God.
The Messiah that would come.
Messiah. They looked forward to the Messiah as we look backwards to the Messiah. That he was going to come and he was going to reign. And so we have the old covenant here. Now, we get into the prophets. Well, look here. Israel and Adam. Adam is, is a protology. What that means is he is a forerunner of Christ. He looks forward to Christ. Christ is often called the second Adam. Right? Israel here is typology. It reflects a type of Christ. Israel itself as a nation is a type of him. And we see this, and I've mentioned it many times, is when Israel, they went into Egypt, right? They made a covenant in Egypt. They went to the mountain and had that big covenant. They followed the Lord just as Christ would go to Egypt and then come back. Israel is a type of Christ. It looks forward. But both of these, the illustration falls apart because both were sinners. Right? Both of them were sinners in that regards. And so in many ways, Adam... Thank you for the markers. Adam and Israel paint a picture of the true Christ, who is the true Israel. But we get a problem here because we see in the prophets many times that they're looking and they're saying, because you did not keep my covenant, I am going to judge you. I am going to cast you out of your land. So we have to kind of understand and grasp what that is. Were they saved by works? If they didn't do the works, they were cast out of the land? And that, I think, is where another one of the problems is. Is we see Israel as this... We don't differentiate Israel by the Israel that was by grace through faith and national Israel. Let me say this. In Moses' day, in Exodus 20, at the giving of the law, he is dealing with a national Israel. Now, some of that was also a spiritual Israel. We see this in Romans 9. Not all Israel is Israel, Paul said. In other words, not everyone who is a part of the nation of Israel is the true Israel. And so as an corporate entity, God was making a covenant with a nation. But he was making covenants with individuals as well. And that nation, to keep the blessings that God had on them, they had to keep the law. Now, could the nation of Israel not keep the law, but there still be people who believed in the coming Messiah and were saved by grace through faith? Mm-hmm. Yes. Because Israel was made up of both groups. It's like our churches. Is everyone in every church really, truly a Christian? No. In fact, we hear about that in the Bible. There's wheat and tares, both involved in it. Israel as a nation, to keep the blessings that God has given to them, had, to keep the provisional blessings, had to obey God. And if they didn't obey God, they were taken out of the land. They were brought into exile. They were brought, their enemies were brought up against them. So, not making that distinction forces people to say the Old Testament was about law and the New Testament was about grace. But the covenant of grace happened as soon as Adam sinned. He should have died, but God had grace upon him. But Israel was a nation set up by laws that if they didn't keep it, God would overthrow them oftentimes. Yeah.
Did they have the concept of being born in sin, original sin?
Yes. Oh, yes. Yes, definitely. I mean, you read that throughout the entire Old Testament. I mean, David's Psalms. I was born in iniquity. You have Jeremiah, and the verse is just not coming to me right now. You have Isaiah saying, "I'm a man of unclean lips amongst the men, people of unclean lips." You have the heart deceitful above all things, desperately wicked. Who could know it? I mean, those concepts were constant.
And that was the birth of the bat mitzvah, an age of accountability.
Yeah, that's not biblical, but yeah, that I think that was a Mishnah invention, and I could be wrong about that, but I think that was a Mishnah invention, not necessarily it was definitely not an invention of in the Bible. I don't believe in an age of accountability. I'll just say that right away.
But I was just wondering if that was an expression of their understanding of.
Yeah. Yeah, so the getting rid of original sin was understood by grace. So when we come here and I hear people say, well, the Old Testament is about the law and the New Testament is about grace, I think they misunderstand categories, key categories. Abraham was saved by faith. Moses was saved by faith. David was saved by faith. But the judgment upon Israel is because Israel as a nation was not keeping covenant. Does that make sense? All right. And I think that's very important. Now, when we get to the new covenant, Christ is the true Israel. In fact, he makes those statements if you understand it, when he says, "I am the vine, you are the branch." What's the vine in an Old Testament idea? It's Israel. I am the vine, you are the branches. It's not Israel's the vine. I am the vine. Israel points to, it's the typology. It points to me. And throughout the whole New Testament and Gospels, it really is making that case. I am the Israel. He comes out and says that, and he is the second Adam. And so he has come here. One other theology I want to get across here is that eschatology precedes, I don't know if I said this last week or not, eschatology precedes soteriology. Now, let me unpack that a little bit, because that's confusing. Eschatology, what is eschatology?
The end times.
The end times. Eschatos. It is the end times precedes what's soteriology?
Salvation.
Doctrine of salvation. Why would eschatology precede soteriology?
In some ways, the end times are the promise of fulfillment of everything that salvation promises.
Exactly.
Much the way all the promises of the Messiah were to the Old Testament.
Right. God created us with the end in mind. And so eschatology is the purpose by which God created us to be in fellowship with Him for all eternity. That was the whole design of this. Soteriology came because we didn't keep the covenant of works. We had to be saved, but God designed in from creation the end. What would the end look like? And so people don't like to talk about eschatology, and I understand the debates there, but I also say it is essential. Eschatology is essential to being Christian, because God didn't design us just to live your best life now. He designed us with the end in mind. What's going to happen? And salvation is how He's doing it. Does that make sense? You thank Gerhardus Voss for that little tidbit. And so, any questions on any of this? It's a lot here. Yeah. I do. Actually, here, the QR code right here, you can see Camden Busey. Dr. Camden Busey, he actually gives this actual same lecture. He goes into more detail on some things than I do, but my source is right there. So he's almost anything by Camden Busey, I love. I just absolutely love what he does and love the work that his organization does. He's remarkable. So that's my source. So it is in that QR code. If you have a bill, your QR code. If you don't, I can email it to you. Just send me questions, comments, slide remarks on that. Okay. Does that make sense? Helps break down categories. Yeah. Because I hate it when people tell me, well, the Old Testament is by works and the New Testament is by grace. And it's all by grace. If it wasn't by grace, then they would have been thrown into hell right away.
Somebody hasn't read the chapter of Heroes.
Bravo.
Yep, so it's all by grace, and so we do that. And if you want to, great. I think he's 20 minutes on that thing. Canon Busey does, and it's actually for a women's retreat that he did. And I was looking up for some other things. I saw this video, and I haven't seen that video by Canon. So I hit play, and I'm like, I've seen this before, not in this way. I loved how he put it this way, so I decided I was going to use this. So, all right, let's go ahead and get into Nahum. I think we'll get done with Nahum, and probably mostly done with Habakkuk, and then we will probably not get to much Zephaniah. You can see I just really have 3 points with Zephaniah. Because I really didn't think we were going to get to it. Now, I want to talk a little bit about, I'm going to nerd out a little bit here, okay? I'm just going to be honest with you. So there's going to be a little nerdy moment here, because I like it when I can see things and you see things in scripture text that take a little digging. And we're going to give you this. So most everybody who write on Nahum believe it was a late 7th century B.C. written letter. It was the north has fallen. So what was the north?
Israel.
So if you got a picture of Israel, that's the Dead Sea right here. Jerusalem is probably right there. The north is up here. And then the north is up here. This has fallen. That's Israel. And then what's the south?
Judah.
So, very mountainous. It goes from the Mediterranean Sea right here. It goes really high up, and it goes really far down back when you get to the Jordan River. So it goes pretty dramatically. And so we have Jordan there. It was the 7th century. The south was still standing. And it had to be before 612. So we know that it was in 612 Nineveh falls. So this was written prescribing in the fall of Nineveh. And so at 6:12, we have to say, okay, it has to happen any time between before 6:12. This is where dates get really fun, guys. This is why it's nerdy. But it has to be after 6:63 because thieves fall because of when thieves fall. Look in Nehemiah 3:8. Or excuse me, Nahum 3:8. Sorry about that. It says, are you better than thieves that sat by the Nile with water around her, her rampart, a sea, and and water her wall? So thieves had fallen. Now, thieves will be revived again later, but it's not revived yet. So that means if Nineveh falls to 663 and thieves falls, thieves was rebuilt at about 650. That means this book had to be written before 650. Now remember, we're in BC, so numbers go the opposite directions, right? So the lower the number, the closer it is to us, the higher the number, the further it is from us. And so we have this. So automatically we can narrow it down that the book was written between 663 and 650. But we have another issue. Manasseh was king. And Manasseh was king from 695 to 642. So what does that have to do? Who was Manasseh? Anyone remember anything about Manasseh? Good guy or bad guy?
Bad guy.
Bad guy. However, in this book of Nahum, they talk about it being almost a really good society where almost like a revival, almost an up. I wouldn't use the word revival, not in this category, but there was a revival of religion that has happened. The revival of things was occurring. And we know that towards the end of Manasseh's reign, he repented and believed. 2 Chronicles 33, 12 through 26. And so we say that happened in 652 BC. So that gives us 2 years, approximately 2 years, where this book could be written. Now, I think that's pretty awesome, B, that we could take a book that's 600 years BC and narrow it down to 2 years. To me, I nerd out on that because there's no way, any other way. I mean, you look at this and we have books that are written that are in New Testament days, and we're like, 100 years is really accurate. We can pick it in 100 years. We can pick this in 2 years of it's actually happening. That's pretty significant. So I nerd out on this stuff because we can really accurately define it that way. So you'll look at different people and what they say. I'm going to stick with here the 652 to 650 time frame and go from there. Thebes had fallen. Manasseh had repented. There we have Nahum. Which, by the way, there's a lot of liberal scholars who would say, it was written much sooner than this, closer to our time. And it just doesn't match, because if it was written after Thebes was reestablished, they would have known that. That this was something that they knew, Thebes had fallen, and they're writing about it at that time. So, now remember the Assyrians. Who are the Assyrians? Good or bad?
Bad.
Pretty bad.
Very bad.
Pretty bad, okay. The Assyrians were actually considered, at some point, the worst enemies of Israel. Israel was more afraid of them than any other group. They were big, magnificent. They did things that... So they were kind of they loved... how do I put this? They loved social media before social media was around. And I say that, and I know I'm oversimplifying it, but their job was to scare the heebie-jeebies out of you so they didn't have to fight a war. And so when they would go into a place and they would take it over, which they were a good army, they would torture people in extreme ways and let that get out. And it came about that through word of mouth, people thought Assyria was impossible to defeat. Okay? It's kind of like the 1992-1996 Dream Team, basketball Dream Team. You remember with all, is it 96 or 92? Was it? I think it was 96. 1992-96 Dream Team with Michael Jordan, Larry Bird, all those people. No one could beat them. I mean, they looked like they could be, no one was ever going to be able to beat this in the Olympics. They went to the Olympics and they did win the gold medal. I don't recall if they lost anything. But that was kind of the mentality. And so a lot of places would just surrender before Assyria got there. They see them coming, we're done. We're surrendering. We are not going to fire a shot at you. We are not going to do anything. Just come on over, take our stuff. We would rather live than be tortured and then have you guys come and take over because it's impossible. I mean, it's...
They did that for Alexander, too.
Yeah, they did that for Alexander, too. So there's this thing, you just... How can I defeat this person? Alexander actually had a place where he got in front of a king and he said, we will defeat you. And the king was like, oh, no, they won't. He says, he had his men line up and he marched them. And he marched a couple of the front rows off a cliff and they died of his own soldiers. He says, if they'll do that for me, just think what they're going to do to you. They are not afraid of death. And that was Alexander. And but this, yeah, you look at that. This is the kind of thing Assyria was, and they were scared to death. And so when you are in, if you're in 651, 652 BC, and you say, who is the people you fear the most? They're going to tell you Assyria. They're at a high. And the question's being asked, where's your God, O people of Yahweh? Yahweh's out there. Where is your God, people of Yahweh? You have this great, magnificent force, and where's your God? You can't stand against them. And we see many parallels of Nahum also to Isaiah. In fact, there's a lot of quotes from both. One is Nahum 1:15 on the mountains, the feet of the one who brings good news, who proclaims peace. Nahum 1:15, Isaiah 52:7. And so we do know that Isaiah was very influential on Nahum as well. So what's the theme of here? The theme was doom to Nineveh at the hand of God Almighty. Yahweh is still jealous for his people and ferociously protective of them. Therefore, they need not fear, for Yahweh is stronger than their enemies and will strip them of their strength. It would be like going back to 1950. By the way, he's going to condemn. There is a fall that takes place, right? So I looked at here. Nineveh falls in 612, so how many years before Nineveh falls? Huh?
We take the 650 date.
Yeah.
Like 30.
40 years.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah. 652, 612, 12, 52 minus 12 is?
40.
Good, yeah. That's all right. It's early in the morning. It's Sunday. We're asking you to do math. I do not grade on that. If you don't grade me on my handwriting, I'm okay with that. Really okay with that. So we have here 40 years. Now, think about this. Go. Most of you are old enough here. Not every one of you, but most of you are old enough here to remember what happened in the late 80s, early 90s. The fall of the Berlin Wall. Go back 40 years. So 1950. I told you that we would not fire a shot and the Berlin Wall would come down, how many people do you think in 1950, well, the Berlin Wall wasn't built, I don't think in 1950, it was built, what, 19... I don't know, remember when the Berlin Wall was built. Let's say the Berlin Wall, but the conflict between the Iron Curtain and us, The fame, that had obviously been delivered by that time.
88,
yeah. But you're 1950, and I come up there and saying, Soviet Union's going to collapse. Not a shot fired. How many of you think people would take me serious?
Probably not. My mom had that exact conversation with my dad when they were early married because they were living in Europe at the time.
Yeah.
She said, the wall won't always be there. It'll be gone in a few decades. And he was like, what are you talking about? And so she had a nice, I told you so moment later on. But
and that was probably later in the 1950s.
Yeah. My mom was one of those people who can kind of see things down the trail. But it's just kind of funny.
Yeah, and so if I had to say that about, so I'm trying to put it in real lifetime, okay? Just because
believed her. Yes.
We could do it. Yeah, you may have the exception, but generally speaking, people didn't see it. And here comes Nahum saying, Nineveh's going to fall. It'd be like saying Moscow's going to fall. And you just laugh at me. You will laugh at me. And yet, that's exactly what happened. That is exactly what happened. And so let's go to the first chapter here. I wanted to spend a lot of time on this first chapter. It is absolutely beautiful. This is poetry, literal poetry that you have here. And there's debate on whether Nahum wrote it or whether he quoted it. I actually think there's enough evidence to say he probably quoted this. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's still inspired, right? We quote, there's a lot of things quoted in the Bible that we say because the Bible puts it in there. It is true, right? So I'm not discounting it because of that. But this is a beautiful statement here in Nahum. It also is mostly in the Hebrew. It starts with one letter, ends with another letter, and then that letter it ends with, it starts it again. So there is a format to this that you miss in the English. Now, it's almost perfect. I believe, and many scholars believe, not everyone believes this, that Nahum changed some things in there to fit the modern circumstance. He was using the psalm to change, so it's not perfect. So if you study Hebrew and say, well, Derek said this, and it's not quite perfect, it isn't. It's almost perfect, but I think Nahum was changing things to fit his particular situation by the inspiration of God, right? So listen to this. And I just want to get a theological point in here, too. Verse 2. The Lord is a jealous and avenging God. The Lord is avenging and wrathful. The Lord takes vengeance on his adversaries and keeps wrath for his enemies. The Lord is slow to anger and great in power. And the Lord will by no means clear the guilty. His way is in whirlwind and storm, and the clouds are the dust of his feet. He rebukes the sea and makes it dry. He dries up the rivers. Bashan and Carmel wither. The bloom of Lebanon withers. The mountains quake before him. What mountains represent?
High places.
High places, religious places. Every other god quivers before him. The hills melt. The earth heaves before him. The word heaves like an earthquake. That actually has symbolic meaning too. And the world and all who dwell in it. Who can stand before his indignation? Who can endure the heat of his anger? His wrath is poured out like fire, and the rocks are broken into pieces by him. The Lord is good, a stronghold in the day of trouble. He knows those who take refuge. When Nahum starts this off, understanding that people are fretting over Assyria, how does he comfort the people of God? Just based on what I read.
He reminds them that he is mightier than it.
Points them to God himself. He says, it looks overwhelming, and this Assyrian country can devastate you. I don't want you to think about them. I want you to think about God. This is going to be a theme even in Habakkuk. I want you to think about who he is. Remember last week I said faith is, I do believe in faith alone, but I said last week, but faith is in, not alone. It is in something, and that something is in God. And so to turn our eyes to something bigger than us is what brings us into not only worship, but in security when it looks like we don't have the army to face the Assyrians and they're going to destroy us and devastate us. He points them to who God is. And who is that God? He points us to the attributes of him, God's mastery of the cosmos, God who is great. Then we get to the doom of Nineveh and the deliverance of Judah. Point number two here. So it almost seems like in verse, in starting in verse 9, I'm not going to read all that. It almost seems that at that point, it's talking to Nineveh. And yet, it's as though God is saying and is writing, and you think he's addressing Nineveh and how we're going to deliver us out of the hands of Nineveh and how Nineveh is a bad and it's going to be judged. But this was really not something sent to Nineveh. It was sent to God's people to hear God's condemnation to Nineveh. It's when you have kids, sometimes you say things around the dinner table to your wife, not that I've ever done this, that you know your wife already knows, but you're saying it to her so that the kids can hear what you're saying to her. My audience is not necessarily to my wife, though I'm talking to her. My audience is to my kids. I don't know if you guys have ever done that. So I don't know if you ever do that. We would go over there and says, man, wasn't that wonderful when that kid did that really nice thing? And we're talking back and forth about this one kid and how the kid did this great thing and how selfish he was and everything else like that. My wife and I don't need to have that conversation. The kids at that time needed to hear that conversation. That's kind of where we're here, too. I don't know. I've been watching this show called Ted Lasso. And I don't know if any of you saw Ted Lasso, but it's on Apple TV, and I'm an Apple fan, so I got Apple TV. And there's one point where Sam is a football player. And he's trying to convey a message to one person, but he looks at another person and conveys that message to him while she's standing right there. And then he walks off. And then Ted Lasso, whom got the message, looked at the girl and says, I don't think that message was to me. And she goes, no, it wasn't. I mean, it was that kind of looking in. And that's what we're seeing with Nahum. Nineveh here is being talked to, kind of. But the purpose is for us, not for them. We need to hear about God's wrath. We need to hear that he's going to avenge what's going on. We need to hear that the doom of Nineveh and that Judah will be delivered. And that Judah will no longer be under the yoke of Assyria. And peace and freedom to celebrate festivals, which, by the way, they didn't have before, would be restored. By the way, that would happen by Josiah. Remember, what king was Josiah?
He was the king that was better than David.
He was a phenomenal king who restored Israel.
Didn't they come to him, we found this?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Here's the scrolls.
We haven't been obeying the law.
Yeah. And he was, how old was he when he was like 12 or 13 when he became, took the throne. He was very young.
Yeah,
12. He was very young when he took the cloak, took there, and he reinstituted the Passover in 622. So even that promise of in 115. So this was written in 651 through 650 to 652. Probably I'll use 651, and then we know the Passover was stored in 622. And so at that point, God is slowly fulfilling his promises there, not all at once, but he does. And then the siege and sack of Nineveh. Look in chapter 3, verse 5. Behold, I am against you, declares the Lord of hosts, and will lift up your skirts over your face, and I will make nations look at your nakedness, and kingdoms at your shame. God was going to bring, probably at that time, the greatest power in the world, the superpower of the world, and make them look shameful before the world. 6:12, that happened. And God fulfilled that. I want to say, I am against you. It's a pretty heavy mark. And when God prefaced it with behold, you better listen. It's God saying, I'm done. My kids knew when I was done. They better behave. They knew it because they could see it in my eyes, and they knew how I was, my tone of voice, and they knew it's done. If we don't do it, Dad's coming in. This here is I'm done. I'm done. But the question is, why did you wait so long? Why was this waiting so long, and why didn't we do this sooner? Well, I think we're going to get some answers in Habakkuk. So let's turn over to Habakkuk. So Habakkuk was in the late 7th century as well, B.C. The north had fallen and south still standing. But this is during the reign of Josiah, so it was written in approximately 630. I can't get us closer to that than that. So I'll just put approximately, give me 10 years on maybe 15 years on some sides. And we see an internal ethical decline in Judah. And the Chaldeans are on Judah's footsteps. So we got a new group who's coming over, and it's the Chaldeans. They're coming over, and they're on the footsteps here. And the question we have to answer is, how can a holy God use a wicked nation for his purpose? How can a holy God use a wicked nation for his purpose? Now, that is a serious question. How do you answer that today? How does a holy God use a wicked nation for his purpose? What do you say?
To humble those who make themselves mighty as an object lesson to others? There's a variety of ways.
Yeah. There is a variety of ways. And it's one that we have to wrestle with all the time. Why does God use Soviet Union, who was evil, to help overthrow the Nazi regime? I mean, that to me is like, I scratch my head there. And this is part of the challenge of Habakkuk is addressing.
Well, I'll just say, even evil things that are not endorsed by God, nor would they say they think they belong to God. Everything belongs to him. He can use whatever he wants to, to accomplish his will.
Even the devil is God's devil.
Yeah, even the devil is God's devil, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, go ahead, Lacey.
I'm also thinking vast reign of history, most nations were evil and wicked. You know, I mean, so it's not like there was another nation out there that was holy and righteous and perfect to be able to be used anyway. So he used
it.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You use the tools you're given.
The pickings were slim.
Yep. And so here we have Judah on this fourth step, and it's a wicked nation coming up against God's people. And what we're going to learn is God is just in dealing with nation, and Judah was to receive punishment from the Babylonians, who would in turn be punished by God as well. Even when the world events are confusing, we need to trust God and act in integrity. And that's the kind of the summary that I kind of want to give to us as far as what Habakkuk is. And I also want to address another thing, is that we do have a theophany here. What's a theophany? The pre-incarnate Christ coming, and like Job was intended to inspire trust, even when answers are not self-sufficient, God points us to himself. In Habakkuk, he offers some explanations, but maybe not exactly the explanations we were expecting. So the theme here is, why do the wicked go unpunished? Why do they go unpunished, or even a greater one? If God is sovereign over even the actions of the wicked, for even their wickedness, they serve Yahweh's purpose. However, Yahweh is not indicted for the evil himself, for they will be judged for their own wickedness in due time. Thus, the people of Yahweh should patiently wait and trust their God and worship him. So there are basically three discourses that we have between Habakkuk and God. And one is kind of a prayer against Judah. So look at Habakkuk 2 through 4. It says, O Lord, how long will I cry for help and you will not hear? Or cry to you violence and you will not save? Why do you make me see iniquity? And why do you idly look at wrong? Destruction and violence are before me. Strife and contention arise. So the law is paralyzed and justice never goes forth. For the wicked surround the righteous. So justice goes forth perverted. The F-22s are out today. F-22s. So why does the wicked go unpunished? And why is God judging his people by Babylon? That's kind of the first discourse, is saying, God, I don't get this. Why are bad things happening to good people? Why are you doing this? We are your people. What's going on? And that's kind of this first thing. It's really raw. I love it because it's honest. Haven't we thought about that the same way? Why, God, are all these things happening? Why is the perversion of our nation being so rampant? Why are people hating Christians? We're your people. What's going on? And I think Habakkuk offers a pseudo answer. And so that's kind of the first discourse that we have. And God answers them. God will answer them in verses 5 through on. So let's look at what the Lord answers. It says, look among the nations and see wonder and be astounded. For I am doing a work in your days that you would not believe if told. Behold, I am raising up the Chaldeans, that bitter and hasty nation who march through the breadth of the earth and seize dwellings not their own. They are dreaded and fearsome. Their justice and dignity go forth from themselves. Their horses are swifter than leopards, more fierce than the evening wolves. Their horsemen press proudly on. Their horsemen come from afar. They fly like an eagle swift to devour. They come for violence, all their face forward. They gather captives like sand. At kings they scoff and rulers they laugh. They laugh at every fortress. And they pile up earth and take it and sweep like the wind and go back to on guilty men whose own might is their God. What kind of answer is that? I mean, he doesn't even answer the questions. God, why are these injustices going on? He'll let me tell you, I'm doing something that you don't understand I'm doing. And then he tells us all about these people and how mighty they are and evil. Why do you think God does that? What kind of answer is that? How does that supposed to comfort Habakkuk? I think we can think about the first verse on that. we look at it, and I think you Rusty says, yeah, these are mighty men. These are great mighty men. But he starts off with, do you trust me? I'm doing a work that you have no clue. I am doing a work that you could, if I even told you, you will not believe me. Habakkuk, do you trust me? I think sometimes, and I ask the question on purpose, sometimes though we ask the question of why is this happening? And instead of trying, and we as Christians go off and trying to explain everything that we don't know about God to people who are wondering why God's acting a certain way, when we just look at them and say, God, point them back to God, like we did in Nahum. Point them back to God. Who is God? God is the one who arranged the earth. God is the one who made everything. God is the one who restores people. God is the one who punishes injustice. If God told you what he was working, you wouldn't even believe it. Trust in the attributes of the person of God. And we get that when our kids are 2 years old and they say, don't trust me not to run in the road, but we don't get it when it's adults because we feel like we have to have an answer for everything. And the answer is God. I don't understand it. It's God. Let's talk about his attributes. Let's talk about who he is. Let's talk about his greatness and his glory and his majesty. Because if we try to explain everything, we can't. We don't know God's mind. And Habakkuk, he was a prophet, didn't know God's mind. So what are we to do? Run in faith to God. That's our job. And so that discourse is there. And then we get into the other part is Habakkuk questions God's justice. And then we get some instructions from God and the responsibility of righteousness. And then answer one, the oracle of God's judgment against Babylon. So God will judge Babylon. But God is using Babylon right now to judge his own people. Going back here, they haven't been keeping what God has been saying. And God's going to use Babylon to remove the blessing of God on national Israel while preserving spiritual Israel, people who believe. So he's saying, we're going to remove you. We're going to not bless you because national Israel has disobeyed and abandoned me. But I am going to preserve people who truly do believe in me. You notice God never answers in entire Habakkuk directly. And then we get to turn to 2:4. Habakkuk 2:4. And then Habakkuk 2:4 says, behold, his soul is puffed up. It is not upright within him. But the righteous shall live by his faith. Where do we see that again? Romans 1:17. Paul says the righteous shall live by faith, pointing us to salvation in Christ. But even here, Habakkuk is using this, not just salvation by faith alone here. He's using this in the trials of and turmoil of our time. Go back to faith. Faith, not alone. Faith in God, pointing us to who God is. See, our biggest problems in life is not that we can't explain what God's doing. Our biggest problems in life is we don't see God for who he truly is. And we don't truly understand his nature and his purpose, and we have to be reminded of his attributes. We have to be reminded of his grandeur. That is our problem. It's not that I can't explain everything in the Bible. It's that I don't understand God. And I have to keep reminding myself when I go through things, my faith is in the holy, just God. My faith is in the God who made me and created me and cares for me. That's what I do, because if I try to explain everything that happened to me in 47, almost 48 years, I can't. Even looking back on it, I can't. And that's not the purpose of God. It's to point us to Him. It's to trust in Him. It's the righteous shall live by faith. Discourse 3. Habakkuk requests mercy. And there's a reflection on the sovereign power of God to deliver. And then there's an acceptance, trust of God's sovereignty. Turn to 3:16. Through 19. I hear and my body trembles. My lips quiver at the sound. Rottenness enters into my bones. My legs tremble beneath me. I love this next line. Yet I will quietly wait for the day of trouble to come upon the people who invade us. Though the fig tree should not blossom, nor fruit be on the vine, the produce of the olive fail, and the fields yield no food, the flock be cut off from the fold, and there be no herd in the stalls, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will take joy in God of my salvation. God, the Lord, is my strength. He makes my feet like the deer's. He makes me tread on high places. To the choir master with stringed instruments. I mean, I love this because he says, I tremble, I shake, I fret. He's not making light of this and saying, if we just sing a great hymn, we'll be done and all our problems are over. He says, no, despite all that, I will quietly wait. The word quietly there is saying, I'm quietly under God, trusting you. That when you come and judge us, my faith is in you. And he points himself to God and who he is. God didn't answer any of his questions. Not the way we would expect it. And yet his response was, God the Lord is my strength. I hope. I've thought a lot about death. The older you get, the more you think about it. Because it's going to come, whether you like it or not. I hope when that time comes, I could sit there and say, God, I quietly wait. I rest in you. I hope that's how I am. I hope I have Habakkuk's vision of God at those last days, as he did. And though I may tremble, it's scary. I rest. Gracious Father, we rest in you, our gracious Lord and Savior, who redeems us and keeps us. We can't explain all that happens, but we know that you control all things.
and we can trust you. In Jesus' name, amen.
Yeah.